Thank you very much, Tom. We'll see you in Michigan in 5 years, and we'll all be 5 years older. So, okay. Our last speaker today is from New York, and his name is John Kay.
Hi, everybody. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. And as the last speaker on the last listed panel on the last day, I feel a certain kinship with Elizabeth Taylor's last husband. I know what's expected of me, I just don't know how to make it interesting. I want to thank my fellow speakers. I want to thank all of you. I think it's a terrific convention. I love being here. I've had this printed. We realize we know only a little. It's been on my mirror for about a month now. And every time I look at it, the message that comes back is, no, the point is not to let them realize you know only a little. But probably a number of you have heard the definition of an expert. And experts are people who keep learning more and more about less and less until finally they know everything about nothing at all. And we are in a room full of experts here, and I will claim to be one. I drank, I got drunk, I fell down, I spit up all over my shoes, and as soon as I could, I did it all over again. And then I came to AA, and I don't do that anymore. And that's my story. I have about, no, I don't know, a little more, 18 more minutes so I can fill out some of the details. But on this topic, I couldn't help but note that it comes from a chapter entitled A Vision for You. And I'm sure it's not an endorsement of ignorance. It's discussion of vision. It's a discussion of spiritual life. And there, if we place limits on it, if we think we know it all, I automatically preclude further growth. I'm going to get that out of there. And the interesting thing to me about that chapter is the first page describes what it used to be like. And I love this language from the big book. Then we were subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm. And I identify with that. He went on to say, the book goes on to say, imagine this, some of us sought out sordid places. No idea who's being talked about there. But the next page goes on to say that why we didn't want to make the decision to get sober was a little concern that if we did, we would be stupid, boring, and glum. Let me tell you, folks, when I got to the doors of AA, I was so sick, I would have settled for stupid, boring, and glum. But the third page goes on to say that if we do what we're supposed to do, what the book invites us to do, what we can do, we can be happy, respected, and useful. Doesn't that sound grand? Happy, respected, and useful. I'm going to quote a poet who once said, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? And where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" And most of us grew up going through school acquiring information. That was the early part of school, elementary school. I just acquired information. I didn't know how to put two pieces of information together to form some knowledge. And as people grow older, if their progress isn't interrupted by alcoholism, they begin to acquire some wisdom. And I think that's what Bill is talking about here, what the big book is talking about here. I want to talk about just three things. Alcoholics always have had trouble accepting three things: the good, the bad, and the obvious. And I have three little vignettes from when I came here to Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the way, I should say that I drank until I couldn't drink anymore. And it didn't make me happy, so I did what I thought New Yorkers did. I went to see a psychiatrist. And I told him how unhappy I was. And we read from Marty Mann's book. And we decided that you folks here in AA had pretty difficult, rough stories, and I probably wouldn't identify. Better I should see him maxing out at about 3 times a week for 7 years, and talked about how unhappy I was in my depression. Early on in that, he diagnosed a Librium deficiency. He thought he could cure that. So fairly rapidly, we had a literary relationship, this psychiatrist and I. I wrote checks. He wrote prescriptions. And at the end of 7 years, I had a story that was rough enough for me to join you folks here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Talking just a little bit about how little we know, and we often say that I think we learn everything we need to know in our first 90 days if we're really committed to staying sober in this program. And my journey began in a rehab. And there are a couple things I like to remember from that. And one is, toward the end of that stay, I went to one of the counselors, and he was a Jesuit priest and a counselor in alcoholism and all that kind of stuff. And I said to him, you know, I came here and I had a number of labels. I was somebody's son. I was somebody's partner. I was somebody's business partner. I had religions that I, a dual religious tradition that I grew up in. I had a profession. I was associated with political parties. I had a sexual orientation, all this stuff. And I said to him, you've ripped all those labels off of me. And the only label you've left me with is alcoholic. And he thought for a minute, and he looked up and he said, John, if you can remember that, you might be one of the lucky ones. And over the last 33 and a half years, I've been one of the lucky ones. I also want to tell you that during that stay in the detox part, and they kept me there for 12 days, it took them that long to bring me down from all the stuff I was on, I would wake up in the middle of the night, 2 in the morning, and I'd go down to the day room. And I would see down there the night watchman. And he was from the deep south. His grandfather had been a sharecropper. He dropped out of school in the fourth grade, and he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a degree from a college. I'd served as a naval officer. I had a law degree. I had a corner office 26 floors over the canyons of lower Manhattan, a corner office, a secretary, all the accoutrements of power. And there I was in my paper slippers. And I would go down and I would talk to this man. And he, as a watchman back then, they had these big clocks and they had to go to various places around the property and take a key and turn it into a little thing so that the people who employed them would know that they'd actually covered their rounds. So every 25 minutes, he'd have to go off someplace and rewind his clock. But in the meantime, he would sit with me and he would listen to me. And I learned then at a very deep level that Alcoholics Anonymous, before I knew anything else, before I knew there was a book, was about two alcoholics talking to one another. Because we communicated in a very, very special way. And he had a language that I could understand. And I told him once how just my life had come crashing down around me. It was on the shoals. And I said, I feel fear. I'd finally gotten an idea that there was a feeling in there that might have a label to it. And he said, what you're describing sounds like terror. And I thought, yes, that's what it is. It's terror. And I had a word. I had a label. I had something I could hold on to. And it kept me sober through that day. One thing about the third step, and this is the third part that has always intrigued me, is when I first came in, it talks about the broad arch that we can all go through. And I was delighted that they talked about a broad arch because I'd had, as I said, a dual religious background. I'd had courses in college in theology. I thought I knew a whole lot. And I thought, good, I can get under that arch. Now I see that third step differently. I see it as a challenge for me to explore what it is that I truly believe. And my journey in that regard has been, in many respects, putting aside things that I thought I believed, realizing that I was fed a group of doctrines that were perfectly fine if you believed them from the inside out. I wasn't sure I did, everyone. And now I'm in a fellowship that allows me to explore the extent of my belief. If I don't do that, if I don't hold on to knowing a little, I get involved in dogma. And that is a very, very difficult problem for me and for AA as an institution. Let me just, if the audio gods are kind to us today, 50 years ago this week at the International Convention celebrating AA's 30th year, a fellow spoke there, and he talked about what we're talking about here today. I'm going to cede 3 minutes of my time to him if I can get this little device to work, and if not, I'll have to read it. But this is what he said. His name was Bill.
Next, let us recall it is a historical fact that almost every group of men and women tends to become more dogmatic. As time passes, their beliefs and their practices harden, sometimes to the point of freezing. Up to a point, this is a natural process. Not all of it bad. Certainly people must rally to the call of their convictions. And we of AA are in consequence no exception. Obviously, too, we should have the right to voice our convictions. This is good principle. This is good dogma. But dogma also has its liabilities. Simply because we have convictions that work well for us as of now, it becomes quite easy to assume that we have all of the truth. Whenever this sort of prideful arrogance develops, we become aggressive. We demand agreement with us. We play God. This is very bad dogma indeed. For us of AA, it could someday become especially destructive. For example, newcomers are approaching us at the rate of tens of thousands yearly. They represent nearly every belief and attitude imaginable. We have atheists and agnostics, people of many races, cultures, religions. Now, we of AA are supposed to be bound together in a kinship of common suffering. Hence, there must be full individual liberty to believe in any creed, in any principle, in any treatment. Surely these are liberties to be remembered by us. Therefore, never let us pressure people with our individual or even with our collective views. Instead, let us accord to each other that respect and love which is truly the due of every human being as he tries to make his way toward the light. Let us always try to be inclusive rather than exclusive.
That was at Toronto in AA's 30th year, over 25 years after the big book was written. And the exhortation, not so much that we have to, well, that it serves us to remember and humbly admit our ignorance. But even if that were not for us or for as a virtue, to keep the door open for the newcomer. If the newcomer meets a wall of dogma, required belief, then we may lose the opportunity to carry the message to them. I do remember my first sponsor, who was my sponsor for 21 years. I like the expression that AA is about love and service. Dr. Bob said that. But I also like the fact that for me to stay sober, to not drink, go to meetings, expand my spiritual life, and try to help another alcoholic. And the 12 steps are uniquely codified, it seems to me, to help me expand my spiritual life. But if that's not happening, sometimes I have to look elsewhere. I have to make sure that I'm not using the steps as a way of parsing them, as a way of beating other people over the head, as a way of working against patients' intolerance. As Susan said, I love the expression to use the steps, to incorporate them into my life. And my first sponsor, when I suggested to them, back when I was getting sober, we didn't read how it works at every third meeting, and we didn't read the promises at every third meeting. They'd started to do that at some meetings, and I ran after my sponsor one night, and I said, we should do the steps together. And he said, how are we going to do that? You have your life. I have my life. We can't make amends together. We can learn about the steps together. But don't mistake learning about the steps for doing the steps, using the steps, embracing the steps. In fact, I needed to remember that this is not an academic program. It's a spiritual program. I have to, I always like the expression, join those who seek the truth, but protect me from those who claim to have found it. I'll just close by saying the other thing I said to my sponsor one day. You know, I'd heard somebody else talk, and they said, Bob, I heard this guy talk, and he said, now he and his sponsor, they sponsor one another. And he looked at me, and he said, John, when I want what you have, I'll ask you for it. So now I am as another friend said, in a constant dialogue with the unknown. Thank you.